Okay, good morning to all of you. If we could begin, my name is Muzaffer Chishti. I work at the Migration Policy Institute and Directorate's office at NYU School of Law. And really my pleasure and privilege to welcome you all this morning, those of you who are here, and so that all of you know this is being video streamed. So welcome to those of you who are watching this from the comfort of your home or from the comfort of their offices or from various Starbucks cafes with lattes in hand. It's the beginning of our series on comprehensive immigration reform. We are launching a new web presence to showcase MPI's work related to immigration reform. And just for housekeeping, our website is www.migrationpolicy.org/CIR is where all those postings will appear. And we are today actually providing you a preview of a policy brief we are issuing on Friday. It's called Going to the Back of the Line, the Primer on Lines, Visa Categories, and Wait Times. Copies are available of that brief outside, and we will soon be also issuing similar briefs on temporary workers and on immigration demographics and other topics. This is sort of, as I said, this is the beginning of our work related to U.S. immigration reform and the research that we have been doing on subjects related to that. We will be hosting an event here on March 27th on investing wisely in the future, how the U.S. immigration system can better meet U.S. labor market needs. So I think this save the date little leaflet on your chair. So please look at that. And along with that, most importantly, there is a paper written by our president, Dimitri Papadimitriou, in the American Prospect, which is also outside, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. So this is about immigration reform. I think, let me say some obvious things. I think not since 9/11 have stars aligned so much better about the prospect of an immigration reform as they are today. Something that has eluded the body politic for more than a decade now seems to be getting a fresh life in this session of Congress. The election obviously provided the political winds for turning an issue which only a few months ago was considered the third rail of American politics to something which, if you notice, the State of the Union address was one of the few subjects where there was a bipartisan standing ovation that the president received. Bipartisanship obviously is sadly missing a lot of public policy issues today, but has actually drawn back to immigration reform in some very interesting way. And today we realize not only just bipartisanship, the leader of the Tea Party, Senator Paul, announced that he would support pathway to citizenship. So, but it's not just the political winds that are changing. If you look at from evangelical church groups to the Republican National Committee yesterday to the corporate leaders of America to the presidents of major universities, they seem to be invested in the urgency of dealing with this issue in a way that hasn't happened in a long time. So not only has immigration reform come back, but comprehensive immigration reform has made a comeback with a renewed vigor. What constitutes comprehensive immigration reform? We know, obviously, the broad lines. And in broad strokes, it's now evident in the framework provided by the Gang of Eight members of Senate, by the proposal of the White House, which has leaked in some detail to the public, and to the work that the Gang of Eight is doing in the House, which has neither leaked nor do we have any information on what it constitutes. But we all know that broad strokes do point to an extraordinary consensus on a number of issues, which I think really has surprised many of us. But complications or pitfalls, as we sometimes call them, will arise once the details of the proposals emerge, and as we say, once the meat is put on the bones. As these details do emerge, we thought what we should do today is focus on some of the less
talked about issues in immigration reform. Those that have not won sort of the prime time attention of analysts or members in Congress. But we believe that those will be very important, very critical to the success of any comprehensive immigration reform proposal. So let me just, before I turn to our panelists, enter a caveat. Though, as I said, comprehensive immigration reform is back in fashion. But this discussion today is not a comprehensive look at CIR. CIR covers a broad swath of issues. We will here only deal with three issues, or three cluster of issues that we think are important for us to bring to the public attention at this time. So to do this, we have three of the best sages in the country to do this. And it's not surprising that all of them are at MPI. And some of them say it's probably the luck of MPI, or it's the misfortune of other institutions that are all here. But let me introduce, I think you have the bios of each of them. Let me introduce each of them separately as they discuss their topics and the questions that I will raise with them. All these three people not only are the deepest thinkers in the field, but also have huge, vast experience over the years, both inside and outside the government. And to begin with, Dimitri, if you don't mind, Dimitri is our president, is the founder of this institution, gave birth not only to this institute, but to various brilliant ideas in immigration policy all over the world. And he thought it was important for his vision on immigration reform to come to the more broader audience than normally the policy analysts that read MPI documents. And he published, I think, a highly thought-provoking piece in the American Prospect, which he may touch upon a bit. As I said, copies of it are outside. But I thought what we would begin today is sort of his general overall view of how do huge pieces of legislation like CIR become successful, and what are sort of the pitfalls for them not becoming successful, especially about the future flows, because we know that one of the lessons that we learned from the 1986 law is that that law was too narrow in just legalizing a group of people, not providing an opportunity for people to come in the future. So in many ways, when people say that this debate may fail on illegal immigration issues, there are a lot of us who also believe that it may actually fail on legal immigration issues. So what those challenges are is what we thought Dimitri would start us off this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. This sounded too much like an epitaph, I should have. I will start, if you will allow me, with a bit of history, since most of us here constitute a gerontocracy, as well as deep thoughtfulness and knowledge about immigration. If you will allow me, I'd like to go back four decades, and I'll say something about each decade. In order to make the bigger point, of course, that Moose talked about. In the 1970s was the first modern era in which we started to think about immigration, the exclusive focus, and you will see that there is a rhyme to all this, was illegal immigration and organized labor's efforts to try to do something about it, primarily by putting it on the nation's political agenda. It was in the early 70s that Peter Rodino, at that time the Judiciary Subcommittee Chair and then the Judiciary Full Chair, started to hold hearings. The Ford White House started to think about this in a group that was in a report written by Doris Meissner, in fact. Then in the late 80s, you had a truly select commission made up of, you know, distinguished people, including something that we, you know, don't do as well, or we don't pay attention if we do, cabinet members and senior members of both chambers of Congress. Theme, illegal immigration, but more broadly, how to fix the U.S. immigration system. In the 1980s, all of those things coalesced primarily in what it is that Moose talked about, which is, again, how do we address illegal immigration? And we did so by putting on the table sort of the foundations of a system that would make employers responsible for employing only authorized workers, people who are in the United States legally. We know it as employer sanctions, of course. We all love it. And, of course, we gave legal status to a bit under 3 million people. We also talked about doing something about borders, but if you wanted to reduce what we did, the debates and the actions of the 1980s, it was all about legal status and addressing the magnet, the lure, which is American jobs. In the 1990s, in the beginning of the 1990s, we passed some modest reforms in legal immigration, particularly employment-based, both temporary and permanent. They look more modest now than they looked at that time, but that's always, you know, what happens with the passage of time. And we spent the rest of the decade trying to do something about illegal immigration. All sorts of legislation, massive arguments, and this time we focused on punishing people who were here illegally, rather than just their employers. We also started to make initially modest and increasingly greater and greater investments in border controls. And I see Alan Burson there, and of course Doris Meissner, who was the commissioner at that time, worked very hard in trying to sort of rethink and rework, as it were, the U.S. southern border. And we made the very, very first tentative steps toward interior enforcement. And then we get to the 2000s, the first decade. And what we did is we put more money at the borders. We really made a commitment to interior enforcement, particularly toward the end of the decade. And again, toward the end of the decade, specifically after the 2007 compromise bill collapsed, we started after, 20 years? To enforce employer sanctions, initially focusing on both unauthorized workers and employers, and recently focusing primarily on employers rather than as much on unauthorized workers. So if you wanted to have a brief sketch of, you know, how we get now to 1913 and to say, you know, to say something about, you know, to put some meat on the bone, as Moose said, about how we got to be where we are. This is the sketch. What's the refrain? Illegal immigration, control it. Even with these additional efforts in the 1990s, in the first decade of this century, we never really developed a balanced, coordinated approach to how you handle immigration overall. Too many of our efforts and resources were focusing on one part of the problem or another part of the problem, but not on the whole, in a sense, immigration system. This time, and I'm not going to take any bets, but, you know, just as Bruce said, we probably have, you know, more of an opportunity to do something than in the last 12 years that we have been trying to do something. And this something has an opportunity to create a whole that is going to be much larger than the sum of its parts, something that we've never really tried before. What has been missing all these years? We know what it is, and it is trying to handle the issue of labor supply and demand. They're never in balance. We haven't been able to make, you know, legislation on a regular basis that will allow us to keep up a little bit with what is happening in the labor market. And frankly, and I'll conclude in a few minutes with it, we could never possibly anticipate in legislation what the demand for labor is going to be throughout the country. So that's, in a sense, the conclusion that I will reach. In this institution, back in 2006, we issued a report It was a commission that Doris directed. All of us contributed to it. It was led by former senator and former secretary of energy, Abraham. And of course, Mr. Hamilton, a legendary figure in the House Foreign Affairs community and community, and at that time, and for a long time, in fact, the head of the Wilson Center. One of the things that we did, because we wrote and we opined and we analyzed, the emphasis is on analysis rather than an opinion, on insight that comes after you analyze something. We talked about all sorts of different things, and we talked in particular about these future workers, the issue of supply of work visas, how to do it, how not to do it, and using our best judgments as to might be the easiest way to address the issue, given the fact that the U.S. Congress abhors or is incapable. You can choose your own words, you know, incapable of dealing with the issue with the regularity that it requires. And we spoke about permanent visas and what to do with them, about conditional or probationary or provisional visas, in other words, visas that bridge temporary and permanent and allow people to move from the one to the other. And we also spoke very directly on the issue of temporary work visas. And since then, we have published probably close to 8 or 10 reports that address specific parts of this part of the visa system. So, if we're going to do better in 2013, we will need to come up with a system for dealing with this issue of supply and demand. Also now, having been reduced to these two words, future workers. I don't exactly know what it means, but I know what it is that we need to do. Or at least I think I do. And people will always say something, object to trying to do something about future workers. And I'm not going to go into the philosophy, the ideology of all of this, but I will accept as a given that the timing is never right in the United States in particular. In the United States in particular, it is never right to actually talk about bringing in more foreign workers, whether they are, you know, high skill, mid skill, or low skill. There's never a good time. In 1986, we were so confused and so under the thumb of how we thought about these issues in 1981 and 82, which was in fact one of the deepest recessions that this country had seen in a long time, coming on top of the second half of the 1970s, which was also a very tough time for the United States with stagflation, etc., etc. And people, the last thing that they wanted to talk about is more foreign workers. So we just never really put it on the table. And today, we don't have to guess, today a lot of people are going to say, what the heck are you talking about? We have over 22 million people in the United States who are either unemployed or underemployed. Shouldn't we take care of our own first? And you have to respect this. It's a legitimate point of view. But we also have to deal with the facts on the ground. In an economy as large as ours, as complex as ours, and with firms to which we have said for decades now, look to the rest of the world, open up global markets, be competitive, we can't but come up with a system for staffing positions in these firms. And there is always need, and here this is heretical, particularly when you consider the 22 plus million un- and underemployed U.S. workers, when you consider that there are always skills mismatches, people, even people with the same degree are now widgets, they can't do the same job. So firms want people who specialize on one or another thing. Their locational, geographic, if you will, mismatches. You can't take unemployed people from New York and send them to Wisconsin or Minnesota to do an entirely different thing than what it is that they've been accustomed to do. And this is only an extreme example, but it happens thousands of times per day throughout the United States. And of course, and this is the most difficult thing to say, there will always be mismatches between the jobs that need to be done and the jobs that particularly Americans, our children, are willing to do. And that is truly heretical, because you can hear people saying, well, you know, if you increase the wages, if you gave them benefits, if you did X and Y and Z, and the fact remains that if you did all of those things, there's still going to be jobs begging at the bottom end or the bottom, you know, quintile, bottom 20% of all jobs. So, given the fact that we have proven ourselves unable to do things, U.S. Congress, that is, given the fact that eras, in other words, economic and labor market circumstances, change so dramatically in such short periods of time. An era used to be a significant number of decades, then it became 2 decades. Now it's 3 to 5 years. Can the Congress ever come up with a number, any number, that would not be outdated, almost irrelevant, the day after the law passes? My answer is, it can't. That suggests to me that we have 3 choices. I better very fast here. The first one is to go against all the evidence in the contrary and say Congress will revisit on a regular basis every year, every year and a half, the employment-based immigration system and will adjust it. If that's what you choose to believe, that's fine. Or we can take another shot in the dark and say, the magic number is 400,000. I heard yesterday someone suggesting there were 400,000 visas, you know, would be needed. Why not 5? Why not 11? Not 11,000, 11 visas. These numbers, despite of what you may hear on the outside, those, all of us here, many of you know these things very well, are picked all from the same place, you know, somewhere up in the cloud. Or we can be systematic about it and suggest a different way of approaching that. This institution has suggested that the way to do this is to have a group of experts. We are, you know, a bit agnostic, not completely agnostic, but a bit agnostic as to where it should be located. We have ideas that you will ask us, and we'll answer about how large the group it is, what it might cost, et cetera, et cetera. And that group, after a period of time, probably at least 3 years or so, gets the experience, the knowledge, access to data that none of us has access to on a continuous, ongoing, immediate basis, develop new data as required, go and look at numbers and needs below the national level, consult with the business communities and with other interested parties, and suggest to the Congress what the number for the next 18 months might be. Always creating opportunities for the event that the number is wrong to actually be able to top it off if the need arises. That's our recommendation, a professional body made up of experts, completely non-political, that develops data, understanding, and insight. This may not be nuclear science, but insight is absolutely essential, that recommends ongoing adjustments to the employment-based immigration system. Thank you very much. Sorry to my colleagues. Apologies for having taken more time.
Not at all. Thank you so much, Dimitri. So maybe we should just move on to our next chunk of issue, and to do that is my colleague Michael Fix, and I think almost all of you know no one has done more thinking in this country on the intersection of public benefits and immigration than Michael has. And Michael, last time we passed IRCA, we didn't have the healthcare law, we didn't have the fiscal climate that we face today. So I've thought maybe the best thing to deal with this cluster of issues is to focus on the intersection of what may look like comprehensive immigration reform and the healthcare bill that it will have to collide with.
Thank you, Ms. That's actually exactly the talk I'd planned. What a remarkable event. Thank you all for coming. What I wanted to do today was to talk about one of the old and new pitfalls, if you will, that we see periodically in the immigration reform debate. And that's the access of immigrants to public benefits, their costs, and in particular, around this time, the access of immigrants to health care and to benefits under the Affordable Care Act. Now, these issues are very much old. They're topics, they're abiding issues in immigration policy, as many of you know, that stretch back hundreds of years, literally, to preoccupation with whether immigrants are going to become dependent on public benefits and become what is known in the literature as public charges. Long historic literature on that. But these issues are also, in my considerable experience in this field, new. Because unlike the situation when we passed the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, unlike when we passed the 1990 Immigration Act that Dimitri mentioned, unlike when we're debating the 2006 and the 2007 reform efforts, this effort kind of comes forward in the long shadows of two things. First, the bruising political debate over the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and the issue of whether its benefits, the participation in state exchanges to purchase private insurance, tax subsidies for purchasing private insurance, expanded coverage for adults under Medicaid. The question now is whether these benefits will be extended to a legalizing provisional population. This is something new. These weren't around before. A second new development, really, is this context of extraordinarily severe fiscal austerity, the sequester, and, of course, with that, all the attendant harum-scarum that goes along with trying to get a, quote, good CBO score, one that is sort of comparatively low and, you know, stays low within the 10 years after the law in question is passed. Now, I just want to say many of you know me, so I don't really need to make this disclaimer, but let me make it anyway. I am not a health economist who is here to help you understand the market logic of the state exchanges, but really what I want to do this morning is just to raise a few issues here. And then I want to land by telling you some of the work that we are proposing to do in this area, which we're hoping to generate some answers fairly soon and to shed some light on some of the toughest issues here. Let me just start and set the scene, if you will, with a few demographics, okay? No PowerPoints, just demographics, so it's a modest presentation here. Most of them are based on a paper that we did in 2009, Mark Rosenblum, Randy Capps, and myself, on the impact of the ACA on immigrant populations. So here are the simple, slightly outdated numbers, but they're only going to be outdated for 3 weeks because we're going to update them in 3 weeks. 3 weeks, Randy will be getting nervous. 3 weeks or so.
Never give it a week.
Anyway, there now, and there were then, about 11 million unauthorized immigrants, right? there are about 5 to 6 million working age unauthorized immigrants who are uninsured. There are about 660,000 unauthorized children who are uninsured. About half of those kids and about 40% of the working age adults lived under 150% of poverty, and that's really very low, 150% of the federal poverty line. That pretty much forecloses their being able to pony up for a $10,000 premium on a health care policy. We found that unauthorized workers were much more likely than legal immigrants and then citizens to work in small firms, and these are small firms that are now excluded from having to comply with the employer mandate under the Affordable Care Act. Almost half of immigrant workers worked in firms with less than 25 employees. Perhaps our most interesting and surprising finding when we did this analysis was that we found that almost a third of unauthorized workers had private health insurance in their jobs. So these are workers who took private health insurance into this period of the Affordable Care Act, and we don't know how many are taking it forward. I'll get into that in just a second. And then finally, from work that we're doing for the Foundation for Child Development, we are working with child development people and with health experts. And the conventional wisdom is that not only are non-citizens healthier than citizens as a general rule, but they also use health services even when they're insured. They even use health services even when they're insured at lower rates than other populations. So, with that as background, let me just say a few words about the proposals that we know more by rumor than by fact. So, our take is that the president and the Gang of Eight's initial proposals would, in essence, bar legalizing immigrants from participating in state exchanges and receiving tax subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. These exclusions would last for the period that the immigrants are in provisional status, whatever the calculus of that status is, wherever that's going to end up, the currently thought to be anywhere from 7 to 10 years. Then, after receiving legal permanent resident status, after the provisional, they would then be, according to the most conventional narrative, barred from Medicaid and other means-tested public benefits for five further years, as decreed by the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. Now, as many of you know, these proposals follow what I thought was a rather surprising and what has turned out to be a reasonably controversial decision by the administration to bar beneficiaries of its DACA program, of its Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, from benefits under the Affordable Care Act. I will now arbitrarily say that it seems to me that these exclusions raise three sets of issues. First set of issues bears on costs and how we calculate them. And these calculations are both quasi-empirical and quasi-theological in their character. The first, most simple question is how many unauthorized are going to enter provisional status, at what age are they going to enter it, and in what insured status will they enter it. We're on that job. Second question, a little bit harder, and that is, will small employers who are not under an employer mandate shed their unauthorized and other low-skill workers? Or will the number of the unauthorized who have employer coverage rise as they increasingly join the formal economy, get better jobs, and get more jobs with the that offer health insurance? There's a whole set of question about offsets and counterfactuals in here, and I'll try to make this a little bit straightforward. As just said, unauthorized immigrants are younger, and they use health care less than citizens. So there's got to be some savings that are associated with infusing this healthy, low-use, healthy population that uses benefits comparatively infrequently into healthcare insurance pools. But then to get to the flip side of the coin, what additional cost burdens will these exclusions then generate as the unauthorized move to the safety net system and move to emergency rooms, move to charity care hospitals, move to community health centers, and will the capacity be there to serve them? And then there's this other question, which is, what additional health burdens will an older and potentially sicker unauthorized population pose on health systems after they, if you will, graduate from provisional status and go in and become eligible for care, but that's after a decade or more of limited access to preventive and to primary care? So that's some of the cost issues. The second set of issues to think about is the policymakers need to think about is what carve-outs are possible, particularly for subpopulations that have strong equities. I'll mention three. First, the Dreamers is an obvious subpopulation. The notion here is that they would go directly, skip provisional status, get green cards straight away upon entering the system, and be eligible for Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act rather sooner than immigrants who have to go into provisional status. What about older immigrants? For them, it seems to me like a 15-year waiting period would be a term of life. It certainly would be for me. And then what about for legalizing children? What will happen in that case is they might be outside coverage for the full term of their physical and cognitive development through adolescence and even to adulthood. Their numbers are comparatively small. I've said about 660,000. And it's the case that a number of states already cover them, and a number of counties already cover that population. So let me get to the third and final set of issues here I want to talk about, and that's what policymakers, if suppose we were to move off the Affordable Care Act and to try to design alternative strategies for providing care to this population, what alternatives are out there? And here, what I'm this is where we really need to call the health economists in. But I have to say that a lot of these alternatives haven't just been proposed around this iteration of immigration reform. These were in earlier debates as well. So let me just mention a couple. First, pretty straightforward, strengthening the safety net providers, including community health centers. This is, in fact, contemplated by the Affordable Care Act. But there's another strategy, and that's maintaining federal funding for charity care hospitals through disproportionate share funding. This is actually proposed to be reduced under the Affordable Care Act. We could create separate high-risk or catastrophic care pools for the people in provisional status, such as basic health care plans that are available in some states. It's politically remote, but we could consider expanding employer contributions, especially for those small employers who happen to be the principal employers of unauthorized immigrant workers. And then finally, reaching back in time, we could follow the 1986 IRCA model and provide impact aid to the state and local governments who are feeling the effects of displaced demand onto their healthcare systems. For those of you who are not as old as I am, the IRCA provided $4 billion in impact aid in 1986 dollars to cover the costs of 3 million immigrants at about $1,300 a piece. So let me just conclude by letting you know where we here at what we're up to here now at MPI, and then we can continue the conversation in the questions and answers. What we're doing is we're working with a number of other institutions, including Penn State University's Population Centers and George Washington University's program on public health in a project. And what we're doing is we're going to release estimates on the size and composition of the unauthorized population, including its insured status. We're going to provide some preliminary estimates of the cost of different principal immigration reform scenarios, including who's eligible to legalize and if and when they get permanent resident status. And then finally, to pick up on Dimitri's point, we're going to begin analysis of the potential impacts of different scenarios regarding, and I haven't really touched on this, but he did, the future flows of temporary and permanent legal immigrants going forward. So these are hazy issue areas, and it's very much in process, and so for those of of you who know much more about that. I'm really quite eager to hear from you in the question and answer period and going on from there. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. The line is there hazy. I never heard a fuller explanation of how this two set of laws may actually intersect. And so whether we like it or not, the last topic we'll deal with today is the big elephant in the room, which is legalization. Whether we like it or not, we always come to the big elephant in the room. And, you know, frankly, Doris is unique in the world of immigration scholars and practitioners to deal with this stuff. She, as you most of you know, was the longest-serving Immigration Naturalization Service Commissioner ever, but more importantly, had very important role in various administrations over the years, and thought through the first legalization program a lot. More importantly, many of you don't know that both Dimitri and Doris actually wrote, in my mind, the most impressive assessment of the 1986 legalization program. It was called three-quarters assessment at the three-quarter time of the implementation of IRCA. So, Doris, if you could just tell us what are you from both the how this program works inside the administration and how you saw it work in 86 from outside, what do you think are the essential ingredients of a successful legalization program and what may come in the way of it being a success that we all hope it will be?
Well, okay, thank you, Moose, and thank you for that glow. I'm not sure it's all exactly accurate, but it is a time to be thinking about what we do know over time and what we've tried to learn from experience as well as analysis. The legalization issue, particularly the legalization issue with the form it's now taken, of a full-throated discussion and broadening support for legalization that is indeed a full path to citizenship legalization is extraordinary. And I think it is another element of what you said at the introduction of this program, that so much has changed since the election and so quickly and continues to be changing every day in the way that the whole enterprise of immigration reform is building momentum. But definitely the fact that we would be broadly speaking about a full path to citizenship legalization as compared to what we have been talking about since 2007 or the narrow political space that seemed to be available since 2007 is really a big turnaround. So it's easy to just assume that that's the way it's been, but it really has only been this way for maybe 2 months and counting. What I want to do here is remind us of the key policy ideas or reasons for legalization. There's the obvious one, which I'll recount, but then I think there are some subtler ones. And then look at the tensions and choices involved in putting those ideas actually into practice. Because the policy ideas are fairly straightforward. They may be controversial, but they're fairly straightforward. Actually deciding how to execute has a lot of twists, with it. And so there are going to be decisions that have to be made both by the Congress in statute, but also by the agencies in regulations and then in simply the implementation machinery that will tip things in varying directions. We all know, of course, that the core policy driver for a legalization program is a very pragmatic one, and that is that 10 to 11 million people have been in the country for a long time. They have sunk roots here. They are often in mixed households, legal and partially legal and unauthorized. And they are contributing through their work to the labor market in very important ways, particularly in a range of key labor market sectors. Just remind us that the last Pew work on this shows that about 60% of those people have been here 10 years or more. So we are very much talking about settled populations and people that are, you know, they are us. So the point of legalization, obviously, is to confront this in an honest way from a policy and from a legal standpoint, in order to confer some spectrum of rights on those people and make it possible for them to advance in the society, both for moral reasons that goes with our being a democracy and a country that believes in the rule of law, but also for the pragmatic reasons that these people will pay more in taxes, they will participate more fully, and if they are not in the shadows. So that's, of course, what we always hear about. That's what the debate still is about. That is not a totally accepted notion across the political spectrum, but it is gaining more and more acceptance across the political spectrum. But I think that there are a couple of other policy reasons, and they're important, too, in the way that the program actually is implemented. One of them comes as from the lessons of IRCA, and that is that you really need to have as inclusive a legalization program as you possibly can if you are going to really solve the problems of illegal immigration. Because the whole idea of fixing the immigration system does mean to fix it and to start with and to get into a legal framework that is as viable for the future as possible, which means that you do not leave behind a large residue of people who can't get legal status. And that is what we did in 1986. In 1986, we said you can have legal status if you can show us you have been in the country for 5 years or more. That left a whole core population that did not go home, that was not subject to employer sanctions enforcement because of the ways in which the law enforcement did not kick in, and therefore created the seedbed for our problem today. Now, lots of other things, you know, added to that, but that was a mistake. So you have to have a full-throated legalization, as full as possible, as current as possible, if you're going to make a new immigration law work. You need to make it as fully inclusive as possible to make the new law work from the standpoint of the legalizing, but also from the standpoint of the enforcement provisions going into place, because it has to be part of the architecture of the employer enforcement as well as the border security piece of this. You want to reduce pressure on the border for people coming and going. You particularly, with interior and employer enforcement, need to have compliance as the ultimate objective of a mandatory employer verification system, a mandatory E-Verify, which is likely what's going to come out of legislation. And to get employer compliance, employers have to have access to the workforce that is currently in the country that they are using, as well as, of course, the future flow issue, which Dimitri discussed. But it's that workforce that is currently in the country, the people who need to have legal status, that are an essential element of getting the employer enforcement to work and getting the largest number of employers to actually engage in a mandatory E-Verify system. Finally, it's very important on legalization to be dealing with this idea of earned legalization versus amnesty. And it's very interesting to me that, you know, whereas the call, and we'll hear it again, but of the last several years of no amnesty, no amnesty, no amnesty, was such an easy thing around which to organize for the opposition, there is more and more now in the language truly the idea of earned legalization as compared to amnesty. What's the difference? Amnesty, rightly or wrongly, was viewed as a giveaway, as a forgiveness without any accountability for having committed a crime. Urn legalization, the idea today, is the opposite of that. It is, you are here, we recognize that, we've got to be pragmatic and move forward, but there were, crimes were committed, there needs to be accountability and responsibility taken for those violations of the law, and so there is an opportunity to earn status, earn the legalization. Basically, think of it as a plea bargain concept, if you take the criminal justice system analogy, as compared with a forgiveness kind of a concept. So as a result of that framing of it, you have a longer path time-wise until people can graduate to the green card and ultimately potential citizenship status. That longer path in the form of a registration process and a registration period is a new idea. It is not one that was ever on the table in 1986. And so it raises the, not only the issue of the longer path, but it really puts into clear focus the issues of equity with people that are currently in the line, the supposed line, through the legal immigration system and the legal immigration process. So all of those things need to be balanced and reconciled from the standpoint of what we're trying to achieve on a policy front, going then to the practical questions of how one actually puts it into practice. Okay, putting it into practice. This is not going to be an exhaustive discussion, but it is illustrative, I think, of some of the tensions in a couple of key areas, and how we might resolve those in ways that I would argue bring about a good balance. So, where the process is concerned, this idea of registration as the first step is a very important new idea. And that registration, if it's going to be successful, really does have to be bare bones from the standpoint of the actual steps involved, but sufficiently thorough in order for it to have integrity. The bare basics are essential not only to get this thing going, but essential because of the very, very substantial numbers of people that are involved here. I mean, we could be talking about something in the neighborhood of 10 million decisions, applications of one sort or another that need to be handled, which is, of course, an absolutely historic number from the standpoint of the government agency that would be doing it, which is USCIS in the Department of Homeland Security. So those bare bones basics, of course, would be the background check, verification of identity of the person applying, an application fee that covers the costs of that registration. And in order to do those, and as you know, as inclusive an eligibility date as possible for the people that would be eligible for that. Now, the background check, I would argue, the infrastructure is basically in place. It may have to be expanded, but the infrastructure of taking electronic fingerprints, sending them to the FBI, getting a quick turnaround, that has been tested. It's being tested today through the DACA program. It succeeds. As I say, it may need to be expanded, but there does not need to be a new infrastructure built for that part of it. The identity verification issue, of course, goes with that. It is difficult, a little bit more difficult, but I would say there's one thing that we haven't talked about much is the assistance that can come from the key countries of origin, which are Mexico, El Salvador in particular, that have worked very intensively with their populations in this country over many, many years, and which, in the case of Mexico in particular, are based on some actually very good, a very good system in Mexico itself for validating identity and place of birth. So the elements of validating who the people are, that is actually, I think, for a registration process, if it's kept limited to those steps, quite doable at this point. The application fee for the costs is, of course, an item that will be a key decision, and I think what I want to make a distinction about is an application fee for the registration program vis-a-vis a fine. An application fee for the registration program would probably be in the neighborhood of what a TPS fee is at the present time. That's the analogous kind of process that would be taking place at CIS. So if you think of the application fee as something in the range of the TPS cost, that is probably pretty doable for people that are in an unauthorized status. I would argue that that's all that should be charged up front unless people want to and are able to pay further into their fine and some of the other costs that are going to be incurred, but let me get to that. Because what this registration then should confer is a secure card, which is a work authorization card, basically, that allows you to work legally in the country, that allows you to travel in and out of the country. Traveling in and out of the country is going to be absolutely an essential right. It's not a right, but a benefit that should be given as part of the registration. And that card ought to also serve as an identification card for purposes of travel, et cetera. And one would hope that the legal description of it is that it qualifies as lawful stay in the country for purposes of states then determining eligibility for things like driver's licenses and tuition and possibly other things. So what you then have is what's being called in the Senate bill lawful probationary immigrant, LPI. In the leaked administration draft, it's being called lawful prospective immigrant, also LPI. So let's call them LPIs. They should then be in a solid, reasonably secure position into the near future. Now, the other requirements for an earned legalization, and there certainly are other requirements, could come in this registration period, but could also come down the line as the time of earned legalization unfolds. And I think that there is a strong argument for allowing some of the other requirements of earned legalization to actually be determined and met during that period of serving the registration time, both for administrative practicality purposes and for doability purposes on the part of those who are applying for legal status. Those other requirements are a fine. A fine is a separate thing from a processing fee. Everybody has talked about a fine. That is part of the idea of earned legalization. We don't know what the amount of that fine will be, but whatever it is going to be a difficult amount for many in the unauthorized population to be able to pay. This is the key number. Our 2008 numbers on the people who are in the unauthorized population is that 40% of them are living at poverty or under. Now, we're going to be updating those numbers, as Michael said. We'll know how that has changed, but given the fact that they date to 2008 and given what we know of the economy, that can only be a deteriorating set of circumstances. So some people can pay a fine. Many people will not be able to pay a fine, and you do not want that to be a barrier from people coming forward. That is just an example of if you make the fine, if you make the back taxes, if you make those kinds of issues be part of what happens once people are registered as compared to a threshold requirement for a registration, you have much more of a chance of an inclusive program that succeeds in bringing people forward and puts them in a place where, in fact, they can become more strongly contributing members. You also want to make it very possible for people to come forward, because I think there has to be a limited time window in which this registration can take place. The 1986 law, of course, had a year-long application period. That was 3 million people that came forward. We have much more capacity now, but we have many more people now. I think we could probably do with a two-year registration period, but I think 2 to 2.5 years probably is the max. There needs to be an incentive to come forward, get this done, agency be able to plan effectively, etc., and move forward. But there again, there are, you know, decisions that need to be made in terms of how you balance the ability to actually do the work with the need for people to come forward. That kind of a process, that kind of amounts of money for fines, etc., sets up a very necessary circumstance where civil society, philanthropy, even for-profit institutions can probably be contemplating right now microloan programs, grant and assistance programs to help those who are unauthorized with the fine, assuming that the fine becomes a fairly large amount of money given the income, you know, capabilities of the people that are applying. So there's a lot of expertise and experience with that. Refugee programs for years, for instance, have had loan programs for refugees to travel to the United States. Those loan programs are repaid at very, very high rates. All of that kind of thinking and participation needs and engagement will be needed to come to the table moving into a legalization program at the scale that we're talking about in immigration reform. Let me quickly say a word about back of the line, because that is another major issue that I think is going to require a great deal more clarity before it can finally be put onto a solid footing. As Moose said, we've done a brief, which we're handing out today, that tells you that there really is no one line. There are several lines. There's a family immigration line. There is an employment-based immigration line. There are arguably several other lines, but those are the major ones. I think we need to think about the back of the line not as a literal issue, but as a conceptual issue. It's basically an issue of fairness that says that in this kind of a legalization program, constructed in the way that I've described it, one has to create a level playing field of fairness whereby the people who are currently in backlogs through the legal immigration system cannot be disadvantaged by those moving forward to ultimately adjusting to a green card and then citizenship. So in order to do that, you can't just let that line continue to be the case. That line has to actually be cut off at some point, because our legal immigration system is one where the line, by design, is continuously being replenished, because as people get legal status, they have the right then to apply for their relatives to come and be in that line. So unless there is a cutoff, that line, there will never be an end to it. The cutoff most likely needs to be applications that are in the queue on the date of enactment, perhaps even the date of introduction, but probably most fairly the date of enactment, either one, of a new law. And then what will be terribly interesting to see is where we come out on double counting, because there are probably, best we know, about 4 million people applications in the line. There are, let's say, 10 million people that arguably could be ultimately applying for a green card. The 4 million people is a false number because a lot of them have died, are multiple applications. Not a lot of them have died, but a lot of them are multiple applications. Many of them are already in this country. Some of them have made other decisions. The most important factor is that many of them are already in this country. And so, therefore, they are also being counted in the 10 million. The 10 million are also people that, for purposes of adjustment to green card and citizenship, is a false number, because they include people who have visa applications pending in the legal immigration system, but we don't know how many of them. And they are also people who might live out the rest of their lives just with the registration and end up not learning the English to pass the test that ultimately makes them be able to adjust to green card status. So we are talking about a universe of 14 million discounted by X. And finding out what that discounted by X is something we will only learn as we're going along. But however you think of it, to be meaningful as a proposition for adjustment to green card and citizenship on the part of the unauthorized population, any way that you look at it, the Congress is going to have to put a large number of visas onto the table that are not bound by country ceilings or by preference category limits, if we ever are going to get to the point where the people at the back of the line, conceptually, ultimately have a meaningful chance to adjust. So there are many other issues. Maybe you'll ask about them in the Q&A period, but that's a taste of some of the more complex details that need to be balanced in order for us to actually meet the policy goals that legalization is intended to achieve.
Thank you, Doris. So LIPs will, you heard it first, will be the new addition to the alphabet soup on immigration. So, is it LIP?
LPI.
So, amendment to the alphabet soup. So we have about 20-25 minutes left for some questions. Those of you who would like to ask a question, please raise your hand. We'll bring a mic to you, but I have to, again, alert you that we are being video screened. So those of you who are shy of cameras, you may not want to ask a question. But if you do, please tell us your name and your affiliation and who's the first.
Good morning. My name is Martha Sardinas, and I'm an independent consultant and retired Foreign Service officer. As I heard all these numbers, it immediately went through my mind, what about after legalization, all of these new immigrants will then file for their relatives to come, and so will the legal flow be able to accommodate that, and how is that being addressed, or what needs to be discussed there?
Debate, you want to take that?
It's a very important question that you raise, and I think at the end of the day there will be a large number of very hard choices that the U.S. Congress and those who have an interest, a particular interest in the immigration system. I personally do not see, the Congress substantially raising immigration limits. And there is certainly a strain that runs through many Republicans, but also Democrats, that seems to suggest that the old expression of chain migration is something that they're going to have to deal with. But think about this conversation and what it is that you read every day in your newspapers and magazines and you see on television, if you do any of these things. As essentially, a basketball court where the two teams have come out and they're taking free shots. It's always impressed me that people seem to be making an inordinate number of successful shots. They throw the ball up from 30, 50 feet, it goes in. And then the game starts, and you have somebody in front of your face, and somebody sort of bumping into you from the side. And all of a sudden, the average just dropped down to between 40 and 50%. So we're not there yet. So we're setting the stage here, and so is Congress in that, for that matter, to try to figure out, you know, what are going to be the compromises? What are the quid pro quos? I was having lunch with a very senior official yesterday, who basically, I won't use exactly his words, but who basically said that at the end of the day, and I believe this because I've written about it extensively, successful negotiations are all about giving up something that's very important to you, but giving it up is not going to take you off, completely off the game. In other words, you lose some in order to win something that's more important to you. And I think that's what's going to happen at the end of the day. Everybody will have to make compromises, and the people with the bigger guns, as it were, you know, some of the constituency groups, you know, some of the ones that are more organized than other ones, are likely to win more than smaller groups who may have to make really uncomfortable compromises, because for an awful lot of the different constituencies, each one of the things that we discussed are extremely important. Family groups want to have, you know, an unlimited supply of family visas per the current system, but many of them may see the full legalization of the 11 million people being, in an ordinal way, more important. So at the end of the day, we're going to come up with something that will have an awful lot of compromises. And I don't know whether this means, you know, where you cut off the visas, you know, in terms of the current system, who loses and who wins, and in terms of, you know, the future legalization, you know, the ability of the people who get legal status to fully be able to access the current immigration system may also be put on the table. You know, I don't think any of us here has the capacity to predict, you know, what is going to happen. But at the end of the day, again, a lot of compromises will have to be done if we're going to have legislation.
So, Michael, you want to add something?
I would just a note to that good question. After the last legalization, if you'll recall, there was a lot of pressure for family unification, for a second follow-on phase of uniting of family members who had legalized, and it'd be interesting to know how the architects of this legalization are looking back to that experience and trying to anticipate it.
Good morning. Altaf Hussein. I teach social work practice and policy with immigrants and refugees at Howard University. For Ms. Meissner, just a very brief question about meaningful. The question I had was, you said Congress should put visas on the table. Has there been thought to taking visas off the table, particularly with the diversity visa program, for example, which still is allowing, I think, somewhere around 55,000, if I'm not mistaken. So that's just one thing. And the second thing was traveling in and out. What about countries that are non Central and South America, how would that work, and would there be a similar allowance? Well, I know you mentioned the secure card, to be able to give them a chance to travel in and out of the country, and would that be limited only to the Western Hemisphere or people that may, the small numbers that may be from other countries as well? Thank you so much.
on the second one, we don't have any inside information on what's actually being discussed, but I think it's fair to say that the travel issue is pretty well settled, that if there is a registration program and a legalization, people would be able to travel, and that would be any country in the world. I mean, this would serve to allow you to go in and out of the country legally. But in terms of the visas on the table, what I mean by that is that I'm sure that that the first thing that members are looking at is current visa categories and how they might reallocate. And the diversity visa has always been the first, you know, one of the first targets. My colleague Dimitri will say that the diversity visa category, actually having been instituted in 1990, has met its purposes of creating a much greater diversity in the legal immigrant flows and population. And because of family immigration and the way that family immigration works in our system, is now a healthy stream. So that there probably are other ways of meeting that policy goal than the lottery. But you can be sure that that is candidate number one for reallocation in terms of other visas, and then there probably are some others. But even with that, 50,000 is a small number as compared with millions of potential adjustments. So there, as I say, to be meaningful, there needs to be more than simply rearrangements within the current legal structure of visas.
Mm-hmm. Alan here.
Thank you. Alan Crowd, I teach immigration history at American University, and I'm a non-resident fellow here at MPI. Doris's point about the fines has bothered me for a long time, and I'm wondering whether or not there's any consideration to linking the concept of a fine with what happens after someone comes to this country. That is the process of integration into the society, something we used to call assimilation in earlier eras. And I'm wondering if there's been any thought given to diminishing the impact of a financial sacrifice, a fine, through the use of something like community service, which we often use in the criminal justice system for people who've committed nonviolent offenses against the system, or also a point system that would diminish the fine or the penalty depending on things like having learned English, having served the country in some way. In other words, I'm calling for an application of a creativity to the problem of diminishing the fine, the impact on the individual, and a link between whatever that diminution is and what comes after the entire process of immigration, which is to bring the individual and the family closer to American society rather than distance themselves so that they feel penalized.
Any of you want to address this particularly, or?
I'm happy to, but that's another I think we probably have a couple different answers to that, so we can all take our turn. First of all, I think one has to accept the fact that it is viewed as a penalty, that is part of the reframing of legalization at this point from a forgiveness amnesty model to an accountability responsibility earned model. That said, we all know that a fine has to be proportionate, that is a concept. It has to be appropriate to the offense. So, we can't be talking about crimes, a fine of $100,000, for instance, as compared with, what it is that this violation was. However, the use of that money, there are lots and lots of takers for that and lots of things that are in discussion. I would say, I think my colleagues too, that money should be used for integration-related purposes as compared with law enforcement purposes, that the law enforcement elements of immigration law are a public responsibility. They are, in the overall interest of the country from the standpoint of border security as well as the integrity of the immigration law, but that the fines that the people themselves who benefit now as legalized residents should go to helping at the community and state level in integration. As to community service, that's something you've thought about, Dimitri. You might want to say something about
that. Yeah, but let me first say one more thing about this fund, fines.
Potential fund, yeah.
Potential fines. They're probably going to be very substantial, which means that we're talking about real money. And, in the article that you will take with you as you're leaving, I have argued very strongly in favor of making this available to states. But unlike the impact aid of $4 billion that was used by states the way that typically states use money that they come their way, before you know it, they're supposed to serve a single purpose. And before you know it, they become almost part of their general budget. there should be some sort of an independent body that takes in applications from states. There will be reimbursements on integration kinds of activities, education, et cetera, et cetera. But as Dory said, the first fight that you have to win, not we, but, you know, people who work with Congress on this, will have to make sure that it doesn't go to its default mode, which in all of the previous legislations, it has been put it toward additional enforcement. Okay? It's interesting, very quickly, that you mentioned, you know, having some sort of, you know, some of you may recall, but it's probably old, but back in 2005 and 2006, I developed a point system that would do essentially exactly what it is that you're suggesting. It's logical, it's orderly, it creates virtuous cycles and pushes people or attracts people to the kinds of behaviors that we want to see among these prospective citizens, PRI.
LPI,
finally. I'm sorry.
No,
your acronym is not catching, that's it. And all of these other things. But, you know, I've, you know, reached a conclusion. That's why I'm not, you know, and there are some countries that have really adapted parts of it. But I've reached the conclusion, you know, that there is no, almost no way that this, you know, country will want to have an orderly, a system that is that orderly that will require, you know, a lot of effort in order to be able to police it, assign, you know, points, you know, determine whether the community service has done too many moving parts in a thing like that. That's why I have pulled back from it altogether.
Okay, another question?
Thank you. I'm Erin Cox, and I'm a graduate student in the Public Policy School at GW. And I just wondered if perhaps the DACA program has given us some sort of way of estimating the rate that we can expect people to come forward and self-register, because I think it's probably inevitable that not everyone is going to trust the system when it's new and come forward. So have we been able to see, or is it too early to tell from DACA or other, from the 86 program to what rate we can expect people to actually register and say, I'm undocumented and I've been living here for X amount of years?
Michael?
It looked like the DACA program was going to be a very good metric initially when it was announced, and we estimated that there were about 1.3 million people eligible, and right off the bat there were about 300 or 400,000 applicants that came in the door. So it looked like it was going to be, you know, we were going to learn quite a bit about the trust in the system and the capacity of the system to be able to handle the DACA applicants. However, it's my belief that the furious new debate over immigration reform has muddied the waters a little bit, because applications have fallen recently substantially. So it seems to me like a logical place for someone to be would be to take a wait and hold strategy. So what would initially seem to be providing a lot of information is providing a little less, and will continue to provide less as this political season passes.
Yeah, I mean, let me just only add one thing about the DACA thing. Is that, you know, DACA has no time limit. People can apply. So it's almost as need-based. And I think all of us know that any future legalization program for the larger population will have a time limit. And that's a huge incentive for people to come forward. So they're not totally comparable in that regard. Do we have time for one last question? This lady here, I think, was waiting.
Olga Markova, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. Could you please tell us what we can expect in terms of reforming refugee and asylum system? And what are the obstacles to address needs of refugees, asylees? And what is outdated and what should be changed?
Oops, the wrong group.
No. I mean, it's interesting that is an issue that has received all, you know, very, very little attention, if any. I mean, there are a couple of elements of that I've seen that have to do with modifying some of the 96 restrictions, the year-long or the year limit, you know, application period, et cetera. But you know, again, we're not sitting on these discussions. There may be things going on, and there may ultimately, as bills get drafted, be language put in that is termed technical language. I expect Kevin might be aware of some of these things. But almost nothing really going on the asylum and refugee front. So that if there were to be things from that part of the immigration system included, there would need to be some really aggressive advocacy and issue awareness developed, because it just really isn't part of the discussion at this point.
If I might, the things, as you know, because are you the ones who developed the paper on the refugee system? Okay. There are things that are percolating, you know, in terms of conversations and at the state level. But if I were to have a guess, you know, I would take Doris's guess that unless you really up the heat, this is not going to be an issue that's going to be touched at this time.
Well, listen, there are a lot of experts in the room. Kevin Appleby is here. You can talk to him later from the U.S. Catholic Conference, who knows a lot about this. We have to come to a conclusion. Dimitri wants to take 30 seconds to give a final thought.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming, but I want to end with a question. I want to leave this question in your minds, if you don't mind, as you leave today's session. And the key question, at least on the issues that I addressed, is, are we grown up enough to have an immigration policy that, while based on our values, and let me tell you what I mean by our values, how we treat immigrants of all types, temporary, permanent, you know, on the way to citizenship, et cetera, but also how we protect the interests of U.S. workers. I don't mean job by job. That's why I'm using the word interests rather than the jobs of U.S. workers. And use the immigration system in a sense for what it was intended to do and it is intended to do today, and more importantly, what our competitors use the immigration system for, which is contribute to economic growth, to innovation, and to the competitiveness of American firms. If we don't prove equal to that task, we're not going to succeed this time over, regardless of whether we have immigration reform or not.
Great, thank you. That's obviously the right provocative and thoughtful note to end on. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Dimitri. Thank you, Doris, for taking the time this morning. Thank you to all of you who came here. Thank you to all of you who have been watching us on video stream. Let me just remind you that for the CIR-related work of MPI, go to migrationpolicy.org/CIR, and we will have an event here on the 27th on immigration and U.S. labor market needs, and on April 26th, we'll have an event on migration. MPI's Regional Migration Study Group will be releasing its report, and on your chairs, you have information about both those events. Again, thank you all, and see you at another MPI event.